Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolf. As usual, I want to remind you of our volunteer, Charlie Fabian, who is ready and willing and able to take whatever suggestions, comments you have that might help us construct the segments of this show each week. You can reach Charlie at the following email address for these kinds of communications. charlie.info438@gmail.com. That's Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E, charlie.info438@gmail.com. Today's program is going to be talking about higher education in the city of Philadelphia and really the crisis of American jobs that this story exposes in so dramatic a way. We'll also have something to say about what's happening to inflation here in the United States, and a clue, a further one, as to why sanctions in international affairs, such as those the United States and Europe has in place against Russia, why they don't work so spectacularly. So very many interesting things. And then in the second half, an interview with Malaika Jabali with her remarkable new book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism. Okay, let's begin. I want a few moments of your time to talk to you about the Philadelphia University of the Arts. Well, right off the bat, you know this is a story about a school of higher education, a university. You know it's about an American city, a major city, Philadelphia. Well, what is it about the University of the Arts in Philadelphia that I want to talk to you about? It's about a vote of the faculty there to form a union, and the decision of the union to finally force, by threat of a strike and other actions, a contract to be written between the employer and the employee. And I want to give you the specifics. The University of the Arts is exactly what it says. It's a large, old institution. 325 faculty are there, teaching art to all of the different people, music, sculpture, painting, you name it, that people who are interested in the arts, who love the arts, who share the arts with the larger community, that's right, all of us, that's where they can go for the advanced education and training they need. It will shape, and as it has, the artistic dimensions of life in Philadelphia. And how was it handled? Well, some years ago, the University of the Arts decided to do away with tenure. Tenure is a protection academics get. If you do your job for a few years and you show that you're responsible, you get a kind of commitment of the institution to keep you there. You don't have to worry about your job. You have to do it. You have to do it as well as you always did. You can always be fired for not performing your tasks, but you have a job protection built in to the job. Most universities still have that, but it is under attack around the United States. Part of making universities more, get ready, business-like in their function. And boy, does the University of the Arts in Philadelphia fit the bill. So out of 325 faculty, roughly, 9 of them are tenured. The other 300 plus are not. That's what it means. They don't have that protection anymore. Here's what's worse. Out of the 325, only 84 are full-time. That is, they teach there as their full-time work in life. The other 250, roughly, are part-timers. So now get the picture, because this is the way more and more higher education is looking like. A handful of super well-paid administrators. A smaller handful of senior faculty who will have some protection. and then an army, a vast mass of employees who have no tenure, have no protection, and are not paid a full-time income. They have to cobble together a course they teach at this university with maybe another course over here. There are people running from one part of the city or the county to another. There are people scraping by on what are basically part-time jobs. That's what the majority of people are doing. You know what that does? It takes away the quality and the quantity of the arts education that this institution provides. But it's worse. The average pay that they were getting could be as low as $450 per credit. Typical course has three credits. One of the things they won in their new constitution, their new contract, and just a footnote, they went to work to try to win unionization years ago. They finally got the union in November of 2020. Notice, that's 3 years ago. It took them the next three and a half years to finally get a contract agreed to by that university, even after they had been a union. They couldn't force it. They could beg for it. They could threaten about it. So finally, 80% of the classes are taught by these part-timers. They have this name all over the academic world, adjuncts. That's the name for a part-time teacher. Unbelievable. For the full-time, the minimum was $51,000 before. The new contract, it's raised to $57,000. For the part-timers, they get a minimum number of bucks, $1,200, $1,400 per credit. That means a three-credit course, maybe they get $4,000 to $5,000. How are they going to live on that? Teach one over here, teach two over there, teach three over there. Be an arts teacher, but also have another job. Stretch yourself out. Exhaust yourself. Use up your energy, your talents, your free time, your creative impulses on getting by rather than conveying your art to an eager student. What a lack of commitment to education, to fairness, to job security, to the quality of what you do, to the quantity of what you offer. Horrible, making a university run in a business-like manner. Desperate employees, adjuncts, all. That's what's happening across the country, across the institutions, private and public. Industrial, agricultural, service sector, arts, profit, non-profit. It's all the same drumbeat and the same misery parading around as if it were this wonderful word called businesslike or its synonym, efficient. I want to close a story about Philadelphia's shameful University of the Arts by quoting from a worker there, Chelsea Hogue by name, courageous enough to use her name. She's an adjunct professor of writing composition, helping writers. To get by, she also works as a waitress and a professor of writing. And she talks about the plight of adjuncts like herself. And now I'm going to quote her words, because I can't do any improvement on them. Quote, many of my colleagues are on food stamps in addition to teaching, or they're on unemployment in addition to having a class at the University of the Arts. We do not have a livable wage or health insurance. We are directly responsible for the value of the education at the university. We make those commitments. We want the university to make such a commitment as we are making to us. She mentioned health. In the new contract, the workers were proud to get ready, for those with seniority, you've been there a while, a $200 health care stipend. And you all know how much health care $200 will get you. I'll take a breath. The next update. When you hear reports about the government fighting inflation, please remember, inflation, the word, means rising prices. An inflation is a situation in which prices are rising. A high inflation, or a bad one, is if prices are rising 10 or 20% per year. A low rate of inflation would be 1 or 2% rise in prices per year. Bringing inflation down, if you hear President Biden or anyone else talk about it, means bringing down the rate at which the prices are rising. It does not mean undoing the past rises in prices. President Biden and the administration have not committed to, nor has the Federal Reserve, to bring prices down. When they talk about bringing down the inflation, they mean reducing the rate of increase from the 8 or 9% it was last year to the 2 or 3% they hope they can keep it at. It's already over 3% now, but they hope to bring it down to a rise of 2% a year. But when you hear about inflation, you're hearing about rates of rise. Some of you have wondered on the third update for today, why the sanctions that were hit against Russia, that they can't access their own money on reserve, that they can't use the international payment system, that they can't sell the oil and gas upon which their economy depends in Europe anymore. How is it that the Russians haven't collapsed as they were said that was going to happen? How is it that the Russian currency hasn't collapsed, the ruble? Well, the answer is sanctions usually don't work real well. And one of the reasons is it's easy to get around them. If you can't sell gas from Russia to Germany, you sell gas from Russia to Malaysia, and Malaysia sells it to Germany. Costs a little more, little extra paperwork, but there's always people willing to do it, and crooks who will get around whatever laws you put in place. And if that weren't enough, here's another example. Very recently, we had the arrest and conviction of an FBI agent in charge of making sure that sanctions were followed. His name, Charles McGonigal, 55 years of old age, FBI New York office. He conspired with Albanians in one case and Russian oligarchs in the other to get around the sanctions. I just want you to understand, sanctions are not something that ever works. Yes, it costs a little extra for Russia. Yes, it's inconvenient. But mostly it's political public relations. It makes Mr. Biden or Mr. Trump look tough. We're sanctioning the Russians. You know what it really shows? You can't force them, so you're going to use this. You know very well how easy it is to get around it. You don't care because it's mostly for show anyway. We've come to the end of the first half of today's program. Please stay with us. I promise you a remarkable interview with a young author, Malaika Jabali, of a wonderful new book called It's Not You, It's Capitalism. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. It is with great pleasure and pride that I bring to our microphones and cameras Malaika Jabali. She's a remarkable person. I'm going to introduce you to her with her credentials and then get into a conversation about her marvelous new book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism. Malaika Jabali is the senior news and politics editor at Essence Magazine. Her writing has appeared in Teen Vogue, The New Republic, Jacobin, Very Smart Brothers, and The Guardian, where she was a columnist. With her law degree from Columbia University Law School, she is a licensed attorney who has written laws and worked in housing policy for the city of New York. Again, my pleasure to welcome Malaika Jabali to our program.
Hello there. Hi, everybody.
Let me start by throwing a hard question at you, but to get our conversation going, do you think it's fair to say that capitalism here in the United States, our economic system, has come to a point, I've been saying declined to a point, where people are feeling in their guts, in their personal life, that they somehow need to separate from it? Is that a reasonable way to talk about something that got you into your line of work that resulted in this book?
I think the challenge is that, yes, people are feeling the consequences of capitalism, but they're not necessarily able to identify what the problem is. And so I think they're feeling that gut-wrenching hurt and heartbreak from not being able to afford a home. Home ownership and home affordability is worse than it's been in 40 years, since 1984. Half of renters today are rent burdened, and they're not able to properly save after they spend so much money on their rent. So it's like you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. You can continue being a tenant, or you can try and own a home. And both of those are out of reach for a lot of Americans. We have $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. I'm one of those victims. I'm one of those debtors. So we were told for so long that these keys to opportunity, these keys for success, like having a college education, are now a deadbolt, locking people out of so much opportunity. But at the same time, even though we feel it, we don't necessarily blame capitalism. We're blaming each other. We're blaming feminism. Manosphere podcasts are blaming, you know, other people, immigrants. And so the issue here is we need to be able to have some language for what we're feeling. And that's what I wanted to do with this book.
Okay, tell me about the book. Let's talk a little bit about the book. It's arresting because it makes the issue, you know, pro, con, capitalism, no longer, you know, the debate of academics or the debate of pundits or the debate. And those are important debates. I don't mean to knock them or to be disrespectful. What you're doing, though, and correct me if you meant something other, but I'm a reader, an excited reader of your work. You're making it all kind of up close and personal. Tell us a little bit why you did that, how you did it, how you came to doing such a thing.
So the book, as the audience has probably heard by now, is It's Not You, It's Capitalism, Why It's Time to Break Up and How to Move On. And as my last answer kind of implied, we are really into talking about relationships as a society. I don't know how much it is, how divisive it is outside of the U.S., but I would say over the last 4 or 5 years, I just cannot escape the gender wars. Like, everyone is talking about it. Part of the problem is that we wrap manhood so much into being a breadwinner. And so when we see that men are, quote unquote, failing and they're not necessarily thriving in this capitalist society, everyone thinks that they're not living up to who they're supposed to be as men. And so being able to frame it in terms of relationships, I thought, would be relatable to people. It's all very personal. Even if you have like a successful relationship, you know what the dating scene has been like. And to be forthcoming, I was going through my own breakups when I was writing this book. And so I was recalling some of the toxic behavior, some of the things that I observed throughout my relationships. And I figured out like how to incorporate it into the book. And you deal with somebody who gaslights you, somebody who love bombs you, and they give you all these promises. And so I felt having that kind of conceit would relate to people and would also get at the heart again of the gender wars, just the almost like a campaign that we've been having, like this counter campaign against actually talking about the real problem, which is capitalism.
You know, it strikes me listening to you that I've tried, you know, having been a professor all my life, I tried to get at something like that in a different way, and I was wondering how you would react. I tried in my classes to get across a simple idea that your problems in your job, in your home, I didn't put it quite the way you did. I did it more around work and career. But these are not your problems. If they don't work out, this isn't a story about your personal. This is a story about a system. It's the job of a system to give you a proper education. It's a job of a system to give you a proper job that matches what you're capable of doing. And if it isn't doing that, that's not your fault. Is there some part that you bring? Sure. We all bring something that's unique to us. But that's overdone in our culture relative to a demand that we have every right to put on a system that, you know, we didn't choose when we were born. We didn't have much to do with what made us into human beings, right? We all know the story. So, and there's a wonderful old blues song that starts with, I didn't make myself. Don't get angry at me. I didn't make myself. I am the product of everything. Is that comparable to what you're trying to get across in the book?
Absolutely. The title actually came out of going through some tweets. You've probably been on the Twitter sphere, Twitter X now, formerly known as Twitter. And the exact title came from, it was inspired by a conversation that I was reading in the midst of the pandemic, where there was a gentleman complaining about having to work 2 and 3 jobs just to be able to put food on the table, just to be able to put a roof over his head, basic things, basic necessities that we need to live and thrive. And instead of people having any sort of sympathy for him, they said that he needed to get a 3rd and 4th job. And they were clowning him. They were making fun of the fact that he was not, again, living up to these ideals of manhood. And my heart reached out to him. I think it's sad that even in the midst of rapid corporate greed, where we've got immense concentrations of wealth being funneled up to the top, being funneled up to Amazon and these railroad companies, in the midst of all of this, people still lacked the empathy and sympathy for other people who are struggling. And instead, it was, you are the problem. And so when I was reading that, I literally said out loud, it's not you, it's capitalism. You're working your butt off. We should be able to benefit from that labor. And to me, socialism is a system where we would be able to do that more readily than our capitalist system. So it's absolutely getting at our individualism in Western society, where no one really feels that we can even ask for help. Otherwise, we're not even being patriotic. It's almost foreign to ask for help and expect the government to step in.
Well, Malaika, let me ask you a difficult question. I think there are millions of people in America who agree with much of what you just said, including your wonderful passion about it. But to make that last step that you just put in there, to go beyond capitalism, to even dare to say the word socialism, they feel as though they mustn't, they couldn't, they can't go that other step. So they get trapped because they don't like what is, but they've been blocked from exploring the other that could be 100 different ways. Why not you? Why weren't you held back? Why are you able? What is it about you and folks like you? Because there are people like you emerging all over this country. It's wonderful for us who've been here around a while to see this. It's just wonderful. But I want to know, and my audience wants to know, what enabled you to become interested in socialist alternatives, not to become silly or support one against the other, none of that, but just to explore the interesting way people have tried to go better, to do better than capitalism. Why are you free enough to do it? It's sort of asking the same question, why are those people that are beginning to unionize at a Starbucks or that are beginning to demand Amazon treat them differently at the warehouse? What's going on here?
That's a great question. And I think I want to give you 2 examples. One about me, and then you mentioned the Amazon warehouses. And that one, I would say, is like a contrasting development, but we sort of arrived at the same place. So I have a background somewhat in these liberation struggles. My parents were activists. It's doesn't necessitate that having parents who are involved in the struggle means that your kids will, because, you know, we've seen kids who divert from their families in all types of ways. But it happened to resonate with me, and that was edified by my education. I just read. I'm a voracious reader. Well, especially back in the day. Now I might be scrolling on Instagram, but I still try to maintain my reading. But especially as a young adult, when I was in college, I was an African-American studies major. And for me, that was my gateway to an explicit kind of anti-capitalist thought, because I was reading about the slave trade. I was reading about the construction of race, and anti-Blackness worked part and parcel with the rise of capitalism, with the development of capitalism, with creating the means of production and being able to support the factories and the warehouses and the wage labor in the Northeast. And so knowing that cotton was such a big part of the development of the industrial world, and Black people were a part of that labor class, a part of, well, really not even a class, we were considered subhuman. So we were barely a class, a part of the, we were the means, we were the factory, we were the machines, you know? And so seeing that connection made me realize that this system was fundamentally flawed. And I was fortunate to have people in my life who helped me develop the language. And so that's what I want to do for other people. My godfather, Charles Barron, a retired city council person, former New York State Assembly person, he was the first one to say, this is capitalism that you're critiquing. And then being a millennial and going through the Great Recession myself, you know, having student loan debt from grad school and still not being able to afford, not being able to get a job, barely able to afford rent because I was unemployed for so long. I experienced it and I had the theory. And so with the second part of just one of the other examples where you bring up the Amazon Labor Union, somebody like Chris Smalls, who I interview in the book. So I have a Q&A with yourself, Christian Smalls, Astra Taylor, a variety of leftists, people who consider themselves leftists. And so the last chapter features an interview with him where he thought he was going to rise through the ranks of Amazon. And he started to experience what it looked like to not have your life matter, where the only thing that really mattered to these corporate owners was maximizing shareholder value or increasing market share, as you would say. And so he was just property to these people, even though he was helping them make money. He was the one that was, you know, stacking up the boxes and supervising people and risking his life in order to make Jeff Bezos more money. And so his experience with it came about through experience and then other people having the language and telling him, this is a larger system outside of Amazon. It's capitalism overall.
Well, you know, Malak, I wish we had more time. We don't. We've come to the end of our time. It goes so unbelievably fast. We had Chris Smalls on this program, and he was very eloquent in talking. And he helped answer that same question that you just did about why he came to see that he had to take a different road into the rest of his life for the benefit of all of us. Thank you enormously for your book, for your way of entering into the struggle and joining us. I really feel wonderful about having you as part of the same struggle I feel myself part of. So thank you very much. And to all of you, I hope you found this as wonderful and inspiring as I did. And as always, I look forward to speaking with you again next week.